Sounds True presents Your Buddha Nature, a series of teachings on the 10 perfections, taught to meditation students at Spirit Rock Center in Woodacre, California, with author, clinical psychologist, and meditation instructor, Jack Kornfield. The 10 perfections, also known traditionally as the 10 paramitas, arise from the story of the spiritual development and perfection of the Buddha over hundreds of thousands of mahakalpas, or eras, in the Buddhist tradition. The development of your Buddha nature is the discovery of the undisturbed heart, a heart of wisdom which expresses itself as a set of virtues or essential truths which are natural and universal. And now, part one of your Buddha nature, the perfection of innate generosity, known in Pali as dana, with Jack Kornfield.
These qualities, which are called perfections, are inherent qualities in our being that can be discovered within each of us. And they express, when we touch them or understand them, they express the awakened heart that is there in the center of every being. The first thing often in such teachings, or for us, is simply to remember what's possible, awaken to the possibility. Once, a very long time ago, when you were considerably younger than you are now, there was a young man born in the Middle Kingdom of India who had heard that a Buddha was coming to visit his part of the world, this part of the land. And this particular Buddha's name was Dipankara Buddha. He was a Buddha long before the Buddhas that you may have heard of more recently. And when the inhabitants of this community and village, the area, heard that a Buddha was coming, they wanted to do all things possible to make him welcome. And so they made an agreement that they would cover the path through the forest, through the leaves in the forest, with whatever they had that was beautiful, so that even the footsteps of this great being, of this Buddha who came to visit, would be respected. And Dipankara Buddha came walking along mindfully, as Buddhas do, with a kind of extraordinary presence and beauty and attention that you could feel. And one young man in the village came a bit late, and there was a little muddy patch and no more cloth to cover it. And there was Dipankara Buddha walking along mindfully and slowly, as a Buddha does. He didn't have enough cloth. He didn't know what to do. And so finally, in an attempt to fulfill his promise, he lay down on the path himself and let his own body and clothing be the place for the Buddha to step, so that he wouldn't get his feet muddy as he walked into the village. And as he looked up from that position and saw the graciousness and the eyes of compassion and the exquisite presence, he made a vow in himself, "I will do whatever is necessary to fulfill that same potential in myself. I will too will become a Buddha." And Dipankara Buddha, as he stepped across him, nodded and made an expression that, "Yes, may this be so. Yes, this will be so." So this fellow, this young man, later to be born as Siddhartha Gautama, only 2,500 years ago in India, undertook the perfections or the practices that make one into a Buddha, of compassion, patience, steadfastness, wisdom, loving kindness, those kind of things. And he did them for 100,000 mahakalpas and four immensities of time. Remember some weeks ago I talked about mahakalpas and how long they were, the a mountain the size of Mount Everest with the bird that comes by every 100 years dragging a silk scarf in its beak along the edge of the mountain and wearing it down. Well, there's another image for the mahakalpa of a vast canyon, not a mile or so deeper than the Grand Canyon. And in this enormous canyon, every 100 years, an animal comes by, a little chipmunk or something, and tosses into it one sesame seed. Or a mustard seed, they're about the same size. When the Grand Canyon is filled, that is said to be one mahakalpa. So 100,000 of the fillings of the Grand Canyons and the wearing away of Everest, of practicing generosity, patience, steadfastness, compassion, loving kindness, wisdom, and so forth, of discovering the fulfillment of these energies. And then if you read in these ancient teachings, there are stories of how the Buddha did this. And they speak to this level of mercy and compassion that's possible for a being. There's the famous story of the Buddha as a young man out hunting and looking over the cliff and seeing a sick and weak mother tiger with her two crying unfed children. And so much compassion comes in his heart that he throws himself over the cliff to become food for the mother tigress to feed her children. Or of this rabbit in the forest when a hungry traveler and hermit and sage comes and sits down weak from starvation and several animals see him and start to pick grasses and things trying to offer food and none of it is the right food and the rabbit is afraid that the sage will starve and so the sage builds a little bit of fire from the wood in the forest and the rabbit throws herself into the fire and the gods see this, the gods apparently become moved by quite extraordinary actions on earth. And seeing that, lift the rabbit up and placed her in the moon. And you see her there honored in the full moon. So there are these kind of stories. You can read them in Grimm's fairy tale as well. You know, they're really the same kind of ancient stories that speak about what's possible. You know those stories, don't you? So these are the stories of sacrifice. When you go in Calcutta, or used to anyway, to Nirmal Hridaya, to Mother Teresa's hospice for the dying from the streets of Calcutta, and in one place where the nuns who work there have her picture and various sayings from Mother, there's a saying from Mother Teresa that's, Mother says, let them eat you up. Give them everything. Or Karmapa, the great Tibetan lama like the Dalai Lama, who was in this country teaching and dying of cancer and giving the teachings of bringing in the sorrows of the world and breathing out compassion. And some helper or nurse or therapist in the crowd when we were there said, but what do you do if you're sick or if someone in front of you has cancer? Do you breathe all that in and breathe out compassion? And he looked back and he said, you take it all in and you breathe out compassion. Whenever a being expresses this awakened heart, they can be called a Buddha or a Bodhisattva. And in the great Buddhist texts, the Avatamsaka Sutra and so forth, they talk about all the different universes of the worlds that can be created over immense amounts of time. Universes made of dreams, universes made of clouds, of flowers, of stone and metal, universes made of light. And in every form of universe, in all places and times, the same fundamental truths hold. And one of these truths is that what brings joy and happiness is generosity and compassion and steadfastness and wisdom loving kindness. So you hear these kind of stories, and in a way, they can touch our heart. But then the other part of us says, wait a second, this is a little extreme, isn't it? I mean, it doesn't seem possible. 100,000 mahakalpas of this, tossing yourself off cliffs for tigers and things. And then you think, how am I going to do it? All right, I want to be a Buddha, but how am I going to do this? Try to make myself perfectly generous. Make myself a perfect personality. Right? That's an oxymoron, isn't it? Right? It's like a perfect cleaning job. You know, you perfectly clean your car. And then what happens to your car, have you noticed? It's dirty again, right? So how do you find this perfection? 100,000 lifetimes. The meaning of this is obviously not literal, but this is the mythological or archetypal language. It's not how many years do you practice it or how many 100,000 kalpas. You know, I'm going to have 100,000 lifetimes of meditation retreats, therapy, dieting, jogging, doing service, hospice project, and then I'll become a Buddha, right? If you do enough of it long enough. And that's not the level that it's speaking on, thank God. Right? It's speaking to something much more universal that is here in all times and all places. Because it's not held in time as we know it. It's what is timeless. And it becomes available not to the small sense of self, but invites us to step into another and more timeless reality. For we all have extraordinary powers and capacities. And everybody knows the stories of mothers who lift cars off their children. And it's been repeated over the years. You know, or the picture I have on my refrigerator of the Chinese man with his shopping bags standing in front of the row of tanks that are moving toward Tiananmen Square. We've all seen it and heard it and know that this power, this possibility, lays within us now. To speak of these perfections, to meditate and bring a sacred attention to our life, allows us to begin to touch, to nurture, to cultivate these qualities. And even more deeply, it invites us to step out of the small sense of self, the body of fear, the separateness, and remember this great universal heart, our shared compassion. So generosity, or a generous heart, is the first of these universal qualities. And it's not something you should do, you know, I should be generous, or something one should be proud about. It's simply a universal law. Dana is its word in Pali or Sanskrit, which also means giving. Giving is another way of expressing letting go. And if we begin to look at our lives, we can see how much we are given to and supported. We're given to by the sunlight, and by the rain, and the bees, and the ants, and the things that keep the soil turned over and allow plants to grow. We're given to by the warmth of the sunlight, by the warmth of our clothing from plants and animals, and even the plastic, you know, the synthetics. Really was trees, wasn't it, that turned into oil over a long period of time. The food we have, I mean, I have a number of friends who've been refugees from far away, a Russian friend who said when he first came here 15 years ago, he would stand in the aisles of the Safeway and just stand there with tears in his eyes, just amazed. And it wasn't like some special Safeway, it was any Safeway. Isn't it true? and the kind of protection that we're given by one another. And we reciprocate with our generosity. We greet each other with goodwill most often, don't we? We stop at traffic lights, except in Boston maybe, where I was driving a cab there. It was just a suggestion rather than a... We don't grab stuff from the stores that doesn't belong to us. We don't take the money from the cash register. You know, we treat each other predominantly with courtesy when we drive, when we meet one another on the streets, when we pass in the hallway here. There's so much generosity that we give to one another. We step out of just where I'm going, it's as if we're constantly bowing to one another. Why is generosity this universal truth? It's an expression of enlightenment or freedom. It's very simple, because generosity is about letting go. It is a path to joy, to happiness. We can begin to understand the power of the generous heart by some reflections together. Close your eyes for a moment. You don't have to move or anything. You can just, it's just a short one. Let your eyes close. Settling quietly. And remember someone who has been particularly generous to you with their time, their money, their love. Someone who has been a benefactor and given to you, supported you. And remember the moments or ways that they did offer their support. And then notice as you reflect about this, how it feels to recollect their generosity. Or how you feel toward them. What it's like when someone has been a benefactor to us. Now, continuing, think for a moment of the times of your own generosity. Remember some time when you gave money, assistance, care to someone else, small or large, and how it felt at the time. And how it feels now, even to remember it, the scent, the aroma of it that remains. And remember as you gave in that circumstance the quality of connection, of trust that you had, that you would have more, that you could give, of letting go. One more reflection, letting that pass. Remember or sense the opposite, just to make it clear. Remember the times of contraction where you were afraid, and out of that fear there came hoarding, miserliness, grasping, stinginess. You can remember that state as well, can't you? Remember some moment of that, and feel the contraction in it, the lack of trust. Again, for a moment, then remember your benefactor and what is possible. Come back. those who are generous are loved. When you think of them and bring them to mind, and there comes this great joy just in remembering them. Now, it's said in the teachings that there are three levels of generosity or giving of dana. The first is called tentative giving. That's where you aren't so practiced in it yet. And it's not to put it down, because even that is quite beautiful, actually. But it's like the thing at home that you think, well, should I put it in the attic? I might need it sometime. Or should I give it to Goodwill? You know, it will clutter my attic and I probably won't need it. I don't know, you sort of go back and forth. You know that tentative movement? You say, all right, I guess. And then you give it to Goodwill or whatever it happens to be, the Salvation Army or something like that. Still, there's that little fear, if I start to let go, maybe there won't be enough. There's that quality. But then there's this movement, yes, it's okay, I can trust, I will. So that's the first level of giving that we practice. The second is called brotherly or sisterly giving. And that comes as we practice more, when we simply share what we have with others as our brothers or sisters. I have this, won't you please share some of it with me? Enjoy my meal, enjoy what I have. It's a kind of caring as if others were really the members of our family. And as you do it, there's a kind of growing of ease and pleasure in the giving, and much less hesitation, and joy that comes, connectedness through it. The third level of giving, as it's taught or described, is called kingly or queenly giving. And this is the kind of generosity in which one takes the very best that one has, and far from being reluctant, takes so much pleasure in the happiness of others that you say, here's the best that I have, please won't you enjoy this too? Won't you take this? And the delight that comes is in the delight of the other person's receiving of it. And as you feel each of these different levels of dana or generosity, tentative giving, brotherly and sisterly giving, and then kingly or queenly generosity, just for the joy of it, you can feel how each is a bigger heart, is a bigger movement of trust and freedom and joy and pleasure. Somebody asked Gandhi at one point, why do you serve these people and why do you give yourself so much in this way and what do you want to get out of all that you do? And he said, I don't give to anyone. He said, I do it all for myself. Do you understand? Because it is this movement of service, of giving, that nourishes and brings joy to our own hearts. It's really a practice of letting go, which, as that monk said, is an inevitable thing anyway. You know, it's like the very wealthy man who died, and there was this conversation, as there is afterward, you know, well, how much did he leave? And the other person said, why, everything, of course, you know. Isn't it the case, huh? So why not enjoy doing it while you're here, right? That's what the practice is. And one starts here, even in the littlest things, to pay attention for the joy of it, for the pleasure of it. One of the practices that I've undertaken in myself for the years that I've been teaching is that if I have a thought to give something, time, energy, money, and so forth, I do it. You know how the second thoughts, and maybe I shouldn't, and so forth. If the thought comes, I do it. And there are a couple times when I didn't, but almost always I've done that. And I don't have any regrets about it. It's fantastic. You don't regret that. But it becomes a practice, a generous thought and following it. Time, things, money, concern, your words, your assistance, your hands, all of these connecting you with one another. us with one another. So it's something you can cultivate and take delight in remembering, opening to. Now it's important as I speak to also remind us of the danger when one speaks, especially of words like perfection, right? That it can become quite idealistic. I'm supposed to be really generous. You know, I should be a generous person. Mother Teresa says, let them eat you up, you know. And then you use it to judge yourself. Well, I'm not letting them eat me up, or they can't eat me anymore. They've had enough, you know. And so forth. And then we judge ourselves about it. It's not easy. This human realm in which we have been born, in which we have taken birth, is halfway between heaven and earth, and it is said to have fundamentally an equal measure of suffering and pleasure, of joy and pain, of loss and gain, of the mundane and the daily, punctuated by unspeakable beauty and oceans of tears. It's true, isn't it? It has both for us. It is the nature of this realm. And I know this week alone there have been people that I've talked to and I love dearly and circumstances, divorces and death and suicide and struggle and work and love. And all the time what's being asked is tremendous caring and support and attention. And you all know this. And then we hear about karmapa, kingly, queenly giving, you know, take it all in and breathe out compassion. But we live in such times, you know, where there's so many more homeless people than there were 10 or 15 years ago, and where Amnesty International fills our mailbox with terrible stories of torture of human beings like us all around the world. Our prisons are full, the most prisons in any country in the world. So remember, there's a little bookshelf in the back of the room. We ask you to bring books for the prison project to send to people, good spiritual books. And where there are latchkey children who come home to nothing but television, you know, and where they're going to cut down the last old-growth redwood forest that our children and grandchildren won't see. And when you live or work at a nonprofit or a spiritual center, you know, people come with a lot of wounds. Not you, I know, but somebody does. It's partly what draws us to the life of the heart, to heal ourselves. And how much can we do? How much can we serve? How do we do this? Do we sacrifice ourselves? What about burnout? Talk about service. I have a dear friend who has been a hospice director for many years, and in the early years he'd been a Buddhist monk for a while. He worked with Ram Dass and Stephen Levine, others, and started his own hospice. And he called me, I remember one day he called me, he was living in Texas, he had this hospice there, been working for some years. And he said it had gotten pretty hard because he'd seen so many dear people that he came to love die in his arms or in his hands or in his watch. The AIDS epidemic, you know, breast cancer, all the ways that people die. Don't think it won't happen to you, because it does to all of us. And he said one day he was out in the park, happened to be a Sunday, and he took a walk from the park and he was just sitting there and he looked out and he saw a man, obviously a father, playing ball with his three-year-old daughter, and they were throwing the ball back and forth and kicking it back and forth. And all of a sudden he started to weep. And he wept because it had been so long that he'd seen something beautiful like that he'd forgotten it. All he'd seen was people grieving and people dying and dealt with their loss. You know, when the Buddha went to Kosambi, where the monks had gotten into a great quarrel over whether they were following the rules or not and fighting against one another, and they wouldn't listen to him. And he said, wait a second, I made the rules. And they still wouldn't listen. He tried in every way, and finally he couldn't pull his hair out since he had none, but he got to the point where he knew it was useless. And he left them and he went and lived in the woods with the animals. He said they have a better temperament than these monks. And there are all these stories of how the squirrels gathered nuts for him and the animals came and fed the Buddha. What do we do when things are that difficult? Even the Buddha can't do it always, can he? I remember going to Calcutta, one of the visits to Calcutta, I went together with Scoop Nisker and we were working on a show for National Public Radio on spirituality and social responsibility and interviewed the Dalai Lama and the President of India and Swami Muktananda and Mother Teresa and all these people. And we went to see Mother Teresa early in the morning at 5:30 for the prayers and chanting where the nuns of the mission live together, and went to the service and afterward gave her an envelope with a lot of money that had been collected by friends and churches to give to her and a letter of introduction. Could we speak with her a little bit? Did she have some time? Yes. So she came and sat down with us. And then I said, do you mind if we also film this? Turn some lights on. And she kind of grimaced and, you know, got, how long are you going to take? And got a little bit less than generous about it. And I thought, oh dear, here I've come, you know, all the way to India, you know, to talk to Mother Teresa, and I pissed her off, right? And then there was a moment you could see, like, how many times do I have to go through this? And I actually feel very sympathetic when I think back about it. And then she looked and she said, yes, of course, it's okay. It was just that moment. All right, we'll do it yet again. You know, it's not the dying people in the streets of Calcutta that are the problem. It's the people with the cameras. And then, So how do we understand this as human beings? Because we're all human beings. We must not make the mistake of imagining that our generosity comes from this separate sense of self, from the small self. To understand the true generosity or compassion, we have to include all beings in the world, including one particular one that we often leave out, ourselves. So it's like Dujum Rinpoche, this great tantric master who early on in my teaching when I was getting very overwhelmed, he said, it's simple, you know, teach shorter retreats and take longer vacations. If you want to solve your problem, you're overwhelmed, take time for yourself too. To know about generosity requires an ability to listen with the heart, to listen and feel when our actions come from attachment, when we're afraid we'll get rejected, fear of rejection, when we're codependent, and to acknowledge our own limitations, to sense what is wise for all beings, including this precious one that sits here. The circle of compassion includes us all, you too, this precious being. And in acknowledging our own capacities and fears with mercy, true generosity grows. Our acts come not because we're supposed to, but from that wise and generous place of our heart. We're in it together, all of us. And we need to respect our limitations as much as our infinite nature. That we can't do it for everybody. No one can grow for us, and no one can love for us, and no one can forgive for another person. No one can awaken for another person. No one can let go for another person. The wise heart that listens to this truth of generosity and compassion knows the seasons of the Tao, the seasons of the heart, For some time, compassion says yes, and sometimes compassion says no. And there's a time to work, and a time to rest, and a time for effort, and a time for surrender. And this dance, a time for birth and childhood, adolescence, adulthood, we need to listen to that, to know how to give wisely. You know, the mothers and the mothers of the world know a lot. The mother lionesses and the mother birds and the mother wolf. They nurse and provide and sacrifice in incredible ways for their children. And then one day, they stop. They kick the young wolves out. They don't get food for the young lions anymore. They look at the young birds and they say, today is the day to fly, kiddo. Like it or not, it's out of the nest. Isn't it true? So to understand this perfection of generosity asks of us a deep wisdom of heart. And we all have to struggle with this in our time. After coming back from sabbatical, a couple months, just so spacious, not too many projects and things, and then more phone calls and more, you know, people in distress and my own family and teaching and things happening at Spirit Rock and so forth. And could I respond to this in more invitations and big piles of it? You all know it's the same for you. How many messages on your answering machine and then you get faxes and email and God, you know. And then you say, I'm sorry, I can't. And sometimes that's the most generous thing you can say is, I can't do it. I'd love to do it. But this thing I can't do. I have to also keep this one sane. And sometimes the greatest thing that we offer is our own brokenness. From Ram Dass's wonderful book, How Can I Help? I left New York for the mountains of Peru. I was robust and eager and young, became a Marinal sister, a teacher, and a principal in the mountains, top 13,500 feet in the Andes, for some years, and then the illness happened suddenly up there. Rheumatoid arthritis, couldn't move my hands and arms. They brought me back to America, to the Mayo Clinic, the best treatment that they had. And I had surgery there, and I did a lot of prayer in the chapel, and there was a beautiful statue of Christ there with outstretched hands, maybe to inspire the hands of the surgeons and the nurses. And I was there having my own hands operated on so I could move them, and I remember thinking that even though my hands were going to be broken and crooked, they would still be sacred to me. And I'd use them somehow, but I didn't know how. And even though they didn't want me to, I begged them and was allowed to return to Peru, but at a lower altitude. Almost everything changed, especially my attitude toward the people I worked with. I could feel their terrible poverty and pain in a new way. In fact, it seemed as if I was seeing them for the first time. How often I'd rushed around trying to solve people's problems without really seeing them, the pain in their faces, the insecure eyes, the nervous hands, the hurt inside. And I got so much affirmation from them. You're the same person you were before, and even if you don't teach or anything, we'd like you to stay with us. And so my ministry changed. It became the ministry of walking together. Some of us with physical disabilities join together to share our experiences and support others when we could. We'd simply walk about as best we could. Many of the Peruvians we ran into with handicaps were deeply ashamed. They hid. We'd come to see them and they'd hide in their own homes. I think of one, a polio victim at 3, who'd been hidden by his family in their small mud brick house until we discovered him at age 8. His brother Julio took us home one day, and there was Juan, twisted legs underneath him, scooting around the dirt patio on a circular piece of rubber. His mother was suspicious, didn't want us, a handicapped child meant she was being punished for something. She was ashamed. We're all ashamed somewhere. We returned several occasions to visit him. One time we found Juan all alone. His family with the rest of the town had gone to a religious procession. Of course, he'd never seen one. So we borrowed a bicycle, put Juan on it, joined in the procession itself. It was his first time outside the house, first time he'd seen people from a level higher than the ground, his first procession. His parents were momentarily annoyed, but gradually they changed. And when it was right at the town meeting, we tried to raise money to send him to Lima for rehabilitation. They did. They liked the idea. Juan was sent off. He had a long, hard struggle, much pain and effort. One day he returned to the village, walked down the streets toward his home. People came out of their own homes. They appeared from all over. They were cheering and clapping, and they followed him all the way home. It was so wonderful. It was Juan's second procession. And so I see that our little suffering is not for ourselves. It can have impact throughout the world. That's how much our lives can mean and how much is possible from the smallest things. And I've been with people who would just cry over that message, and I too have wept. So the perfection of generosity isn't so much by making and becoming and fixing, but by our being. It's the shift from I helping somebody else to us, to when we sit and discover the truth of selflessness, that we all breathe the same air and drink the same water and come of the same earth, and that nothing can be said, this is mine. It's mine for a moment. It's ours. And to listen really deeply, to love really deeply, is not a process of fixing another person or situation. True generosity stems from the same silent source, a communion of silence of the heart. And true compassion just is. It's contagious. It's reckless. Rumi talks about it as the millstone that never stops. It's joy for no reason. It moves whenever we can let go of the sense of deficiency and small self and connect with the abundance that gave us life. I see it a lot in little kids. I remember my daughter Caroline, how often, you know, she'd get a candy or a cookie or something, she'd want to stuff it in my mouth, or she'd have things and meet other kids and want to give it to them. You know how natural it is to us when we feel it. Rumi writes, "Lord, the air smells good today, straight from the mysteries within the inner courts of the divine. A grace like new clothes thrown across the garden, free medicine for everybody. Face to face with a lion, I grow leonine. Walking out of the treasury building, I feel generous. Anyone still sober in this weather must be really afraid, don't you think? Walking out of the treasury building, I feel generous." That's really where it comes from. From that sense of well-being that is our true nature, that is our heart. And the Iroquois train their children. They have this wonderful ceremony where they take a three-year-old child and put them in the middle of the circle and give them all that they can to drink and eat and beautiful things to wear, all the elders gathered around, and someone from out the side the circle cries, "I'm thirsty, I'm thirsty." But the child is given every wonderful beverage, and then when they're full, the child goes and takes the drink and says, "Here, you share this too." And the child's given all the wonderful food. "I'm hungry," the voice cries. "Oh, you too, enjoy this." And the child is led to share what they have. I'm cold, and they bring the clothes to place around them. Maybe generosity is simply about trust, that ability to open from the body of fear, the small self, to the unimagined possibilities of the heart. Each day we can and do care for one another. Each day we can heal the sick, feed the hungry, make true community, make peace where there is racism and division, make peace among the nations. Not as generosity or helping others, but because it's our brothers and sisters, it's really ourselves, it's us. It's like Ram Dass's teacher, Neem Karoli Baba, said when Ram Dass said, how do I get enlightened, awaken, become free? He said, love people, feed people. That's how. Not helping others, but helping ourselves. So Nisargadatta Maharaj in Bombay, who spoke about all of this as a dance with no self or other, he said, it appears out of nowhere, this body. You didn't ask for it, did you? It just happened. Sights and sounds come and go. No one knows where they come from. It arises out of nothing and disappears into nothing. And in this great dark space, there is only one movement, the movement of love. Daniel Berrigan wrote as part of an essay, he said, I would give almost anything for the look in a hungry man's eye when I give him the bread that I baked with my own hands. So the perfection of generosity is really simply that love that we all have and that we long to express, to find ways to connect. Let's sit for a moment. Since we're going to have to give it all up anyway in the end, why not do it now with joy and delight? Bring that goodness to the world.
This concludes part one of Your Buddha Nature with Jack Kornfield. Please turn the tape over and rewind for part two.